Let's get started now. As many of you know, I'm David Grusky, and I want to welcome you to the third debate in a quarter-long series of debates about how poverty and inequality are generated and what we might do to reduce them. This debate series is co-sponsored by the Stanford Center on Ethics and the Elfinworks Fund, and is hosted by the Stanford Center for the Study of Poverty and Inequality, a program within the Institute for the Research in the Social Sciences. And we're going to be focusing today on microfinance and what role it might best play in reducing poverty. We're very honored to have with us here today two leaders in the field of microlending. First, we have with us Eric Lieber, who's the founding executive director of Lenders for Community Development, soon to be renamed the Opportunity Fund. Got that pitch in there. He's received many awards within the microlending field. Is responsible for the largest individual development account program in the U.S. And is one of the pioneers for bringing private sector funding into letting them do microfinance work in the U.S. Second, we're also very honored to have with us Tracy Pettengill Turner, founder of MicroPlace, an organization based on the premise that individual investors, not just institutional investors, but individual investors should be able to easily make investments in microlending. Last year, we had representatives from the founders of Kiva come here in a debate of this sort with Eric, and so I think it's fitting now to have the founder of MicroPlace here with us, an alternative, but I suspect would be our complementary approach to advancing microlending. So we're going to proceed as follows. We'll lead off with Tracy, a 20-minute opening presentation, followed by an equivalent 20-minute presentation or so by Eric. Then the leads have an opportunity for 5-minute rebuttals, and then we'll just open up to questions from the floor. We'll stop at 3:30 sharp. So welcome.
Yeah, no, not snacks, unfortunately, although that probably would have been even better. Okay. I heard it was a debate, so I brought my boxing gloves. I stole these from the gym, so I'm not even exactly sure how to put them on. All right, you're supposed to laugh. This is funny. Jeez, please. Okay, how many of you know what microfinance is? Guys are so wimpy. Raise your hands so I can see them. Okay, good. So majority of you. So if you don't know what microfinance is, basically it is the idea that instead of providing charity to the world's working poor, people who work hard every day to put food on the table at night, instead how about giving them a loan? And it could be as little as $10, $100, $200, that kind of order of magnitude. And if you provide somebody with a loan, they can use that loan to grow whatever their little small businesses that they are running to be able to make ends meet and bring in income for their family. And so if you imagine like a goat herder in Uganda, might want to buy some more goats, sell milk in the market, make a little bit of money to be able to make ends meet, or a seamstress in Bolivia who needs a new sewing machine to be able to run a sewing business and make money to feed her family. So those are the kinds of businesses that we're talking about, and it's a very different picture than you normally think of when you think of poverty in the world. I mean, normally I think the images that I always had growing up were that poor people were, you know, needed charity. Maybe they didn't work as hard as my family worked, and therefore, you know, they needed some handouts. Or maybe they weren't as smart as I was, and therefore they, you know, they could use a helping hand. But actually, a lot of those myths are just that, they're myths. that when you're actually in the developing world, how many of you have actually traveled to developing country? Okay, great. So you've seen, you've been on the ground and seen, you know, they're just as smart as any of us. They're just as hardworking, in fact, often harder working than I am. And they have to be, because if they're not, then it's not like they can't buy another car. It's like they can't put dinner on the table for their kids or buy medicine for their parents. It is really hot in here, and these are super hot, so I'm going to take them off. Although I don't know how to take them off. Here, help me.
So that's the idea behind microfinance. Okay, so then, if you fast forward, there are something like 10,000 microfinance organizations all around the world, in villages and cities and across the developing world, and even here in the U.S. And it turns out that when you provide loans, these little loans to the working poor, they repay. And they repay with interest. And their default rates are extremely low. It's like 2%. And if you compare that to credit cards in the U.S., we default to, I don't know, 5% or so. We're 2.5 times worse. So it's actually really good business. And so what that means is all these little microfinance organizations out around the world, many of them are now actually big financial institutions with $1 billion of assets that they manage, and you know, hundreds of millions of clients. I think we're up to about 125 million microfinance borrowers around the world today. So that's great, but that's only about a tenth of the potential. So there's about 1 billion people in the world who could benefit from microfinance if we gave them the opportunity to access a loan. And so, you know, we've only really just begun to scratch the surface in terms of the potential. But the exciting moment where we are in the evolution of microfinance is that the model is basically proven, right? We've seen in all different cultures, doesn't matter what your ethnic background is, it doesn't matter what your religious background is, doesn't matter the, you know, kind of government infrastructure that you operate under, that microfinance generally around the world is an effective solution to global poverty when addressing the world's working poor. So those microfinance institutions I was mentioning, well, because of the nature of what microfinance is, they can be profitable organizations. That's weird. Usually when we talk about poverty, we talk about charitable organizations. We talk about NGOs, non-governmental organizations, or in our lingo, nonprofits. Well, actually, these microfinance institutions can be, if they achieve scale and are well-run and so forth, can actually be profitable institutions. And many of them have turned into, you know, banks, just like the banks that we would access here, you know, Wells Fargo down the street or Citibank or whatever. But they're specifically targeted at this strata, which is the world's working poor. So the debate today is about whether or not it's a good idea to commercialize microfinance, meaning address this market, this opportunity to address global poverty in a profitable way, versus focusing more on the development, or you know, making sure that the focus is on the poorest of the poor, and not approached in a commercial or profitable way. So there's a couple of, I think, key points that I want to make on the kind of pro kind of commercialization side of the story. The first is, you know, I've spent a lot of time in East Africa and in Bangladesh. I actually worked at the Grameen Bank, which is the, Professor Yunus founded the Grameen Bank in the 70s, and in 2006 he won the Nobel Peace Prize. And so I have a little bit of experience actually on the ground working with many of the borrowers who have accessed these loans. And the thing that I find so magical and so powerful about microfinance that's different from other vehicles we've used to address poverty in the past is the fact that, you know, when you go and you actually sit down with, you know, Pooja Patel, who needs a sewing machine to run her sewing business, you know, she'll look you straight in the eye, and she'll tell you that how much she values and how much she cares about the opportunity to access a loan. which seems odd when you think, well, wouldn't you rather just have a handout? Wouldn't you rather just somebody give you $50 instead of lending you $50 that you have to repay with interest? And she'll say no, that, you know, she'll look you straight in the eye and say how much she feels respected and how important she feels as a human being. It's one of the first times in her life she's had the opportunity to be treated like a businesswoman. So this is really about the dignity that comes with treating somebody as a business equal as opposed to a handout. One of the leaders in microfinance is a friend of mine who runs the Deutsche Bank Microfinance Fund once said that he thinks microfinance is about, you know, when you give someone a handout, you take away a little piece of their dignity. But when you give that person a loan, you actually give them back a piece of their dignity. And so I think fundamentally microfinance is about investing. It's about a commercial solution to poverty. The second point is that charity dollars just aren't enough. If we added up every single charitable dollar that is donated in the US every year, which is about $200 billion or so, it's a little bit more now, and that's every dollar that goes to churches, that goes to alma maters, you know, those are the kind of big charitable recipients. And instead, we diverted every one of those dollars to microfinance, it still wouldn't be enough. I mean, there's about $300 billion worth of need in the microfinance industry for it to reach those billion people who if they could access loans, would benefit. So, and along those lines, if you look at the average U.S. household, they donate about $1,000 a year. They have $100,000 worth of investable assets. So we're talking totally different orders of magnitude when you start thinking about this as an investment rather than as charity. And then the third point is this is about a sustainable solution, right? So charity dollars, you donate once and they're gone. And they might be put to good use, but they might not. I don't, you know, hard to know. But they can only be used once and that's it. Whereas if you invest in microfinance, then you can actually get your money back, get it back with interest, and then you can use it again. You could reinvest it into helping more people get out of poverty. So it's kind of a virtuous cycle. I like to compare it to recycling because there's such an environmental movement right now. You know, we're all kind of gung-ho about recycling right now, right? Well, imagine you could recycle your dollars as well and then think of how many people. I mean, you have basically an infinite capacity to end poverty. So I forgot to mention at the beginning, MicroPlace is a website that I run. That's my day job. And so if you have $100, you could go to a MicroPlace today. You could invest it in a microfinance security anywhere in the world. Pick a country that you like. You can go find an investment there and make an investment. And in 6 months or a year or two years, depending on, you know, what you invest in, you get your money back with interest, and you could invest it again and again and again. And you can do that for the rest of your life. And think of how many people you could enable to get out of poverty. And you can actually, on MicroPlace, play with a little slider and decide how many people you want to enable to access loans. So again, the idea that you can invest and help people out of poverty. And then finally, this is kind of the fourth key point I just wanted to make is that Darwinism, when you think about the world's working poor, sounds like a bad combination. You don't want to use that word. But when you think about the microfinance organizations, there's 10,000 of these around the world. And you know what? Probably half of them should go away. Because if we focus on scaling the big ones, and really making those big and effective and have scale and operate efficiently and we know are well run, then we'll be able to address microfinance much more cost effectively, and so investing in those large organizations I think is key. And then finally, I don't know, am I running out of time or am I okay? I'm okay?
Sure.
Yeah. Good. I think the final key point, which I think is it's a fairly controversial point, but one that I believe in, and so, you know, Eric can run with this one, I'm sure, is that subsidized capital or charity capital invested in the microfinance industry actually retards the growth of the industry. And that doesn't make much sense on the surface, right? Because, well, you know, some donation capital thrown in there can only be good, right? It can only help some of the smaller ones, some of the, you know, organizations that are kind of trying new things and that kind of thing. But if you think about, you know, some of the dynamics happening today actually illustrate the point. So there are some government agencies like USAID or the World Bank or the IFC that provide capital to these microfinance organizations around the world. And they are able to do it at subsidized rates, right? At not at commercial rates that like a Morgan Stanley or a Deutsche Bank or a Credit Suisse or a player like that could compete with. And so what that means is, you know, if they're in there with capital where they're investing in a microfinance institution and asking the microfinance institution, just pay me back 1 or 2 or 3%, you know, something like that. And then the microfinance institution says, great, I like that guy. That's only a couple percent cost to me to access that $1 million or whatever it is. And then Morgan Stanley comes along and says, well, commercial rate might be 8 or 9 or 10 or 15%. I can't responsibly invest and only get a 2% return here. Like, so I'm going to go away. I'm not going to invest in this. And so the larger financial institutions that have basically an infinite source of capital, if they can invest it at commercial rates, would shy away, right? So we call this phenomenon crowding out. And if it really, we've seen a little bit of it happening. If it persists, then it's a shame that we're essentially limiting the amount of capital that will flow into the microfinance industry. So I would argue that allowing just the, you know, kind of commercial rates to be charged for capital flowing into microfinance would allow the industry to grow much more quickly, and therefore allow those 900 million microfinance borrowers out there that don't have access to loans yet because the industry hasn't reached them yet could potentially access it. So I do think that, having said that, I do think there is a role for subsidized capital, some donation capital, or some market rates of capital, which is there are some R&D type opportunities in microfinance, just experimenting and learning, you know, new models, going into geographies where it's really difficult, like, you know, bringing microfinance to Sudan or bringing microfinance to Iraq or bringing microfinance to Afghanistan. Pretty hard right now. Pretty hard to do that with good rates of return. There is microfinance in all of those places, but limited in terms of the potential. So, let's see. I think those are my key. Oh, so I think just a couple of next steps, because it's not perfect. You know, we're not a fully commercial asset class right now. Like, I, you know, given what I do, I run around talking to as many people as I can about how, you know, you all have investments in stocks and you have investments in bonds and maybe you have some real estate and, you know, you have your portfolio of different things that you own. And what if you had a slice that was for microfinance? What if you were to think about this as an investment opportunity, right? So instead of getting out your charity wallet, in which the average American has $1,000, instead you got out your investment wallet, in which case the average, you know, American has $100,000, there's a lot more capital there to be be placed in the industry. So the things I think that we're missing, though, to actually get us to a place where it is truly an asset class that you can compare to other investment opportunities are we need more transparency in the industry, and that's one of the things that we're working on at Microplace is how do we enable you to pick a microfinance institution to invest in that you know is really well run. It's got great management that's actually effectively reaching the poorest of the poor, who's, you know you're going to get your investment dollars back with the interest that they promised. And so transparency is something the internet is really good at, right? So eBay, before eBay existed, if you can remember back then, you know, if you wanted to buy a used car, go down to the used car salesman. Maybe he's giving you an honest deal, maybe not, hard to know. You go online right now, you check on eBay for a used car, you're going to know exactly how much that car is worth because you can compare. And
There are close-up shots of the dents on the back of the car, right? That's how efficient the market is, that the seller actually has to show you a close-up of the dent. I mean, that's transparency to the to its greatest greatest extent. And so if you translate that to what we're thinking about in microfinance, you know, you want to know before you make an investment in a microfinance institution that that one is really well run, and you want to see all their dents and bruises, and you know, you want to have that knowledge. And so that's one of the things that I think the industry still needs to develop. So I don't know if I beat you up enough, but it's a good start. Anyway, thanks. It'd be more fun to get into the Q&A and stuff.
Okay. So I'm Eric Weaver. I'm the CEO and founder of Lenders for Community Development, which is a nonprofit financial institution based in San Jose. And we are doing microfinance lending here in the Bay Area. We do it on a much smaller scale than it's done in developing countries, and there are a lot of reasons why it's more difficult to scale here. One of them being that it's really, there has not been any sort of model to commercialize it like there has been overseas. So, you know, we're very much dependent on philanthropic resources. We're the largest, you know, lenders of our kind in the Bay Area and growing, you know, but so what I'm gonna sort of make a couple of points. In my position, I'm even though I do microfinance lending for a living, we do other things as well in our organization, but it's definitely a big focus of what we do. I have kind of a, you know, more nuanced and somewhat contrarian view about it, especially as it relates to commercialization. And my feeling is that when it's practiced in a way where the focus is on the social mission, microfinance lending absolutely is a good thing, can be, you know, have positive benefits for people. But there are a couple things at work that I think present challenges. One is that I think it's been really tremendously overhyped, and that actually has downsides in a lot of different ways. And I also believe that it's the sort of attempts to commercialize it rapidly without effective regulations, which do not exist in many of the countries where the attempts are being made to commercialize it, will have some significant negative consequences that need to be thought about very carefully. So first, what is good about it? You know, our experience practicing it here, we're seeing some very good impacts. 85% of the businesses we lend to stay in business, or are still in business since we made the loans, and that's, you know, 13 years of doing this, versus a rate of about 44% survival rate nationwide for businesses. Our businesses see an increase in net income of about 65% over the life of their working with us. We measure all this, you know, on a very rigorous basis. And our businesses create about 4.3 jobs per business. They're not the greatest jobs in the world. I mean, you know, these are very small businesses, they're jobs. So we know that what we're doing, the way we're practicing it, we know that we're having, you know, this kind of positive impact on the people we work with. If you look overseas, why is it good? Whenever you hear almost always when you hear talk about microfinance, you hear talk about ending poverty. You know, we're going to end poverty. Microfinance is going to end poverty. How do you want to help somebody get out of poverty? Well, in fact, microfinance does have, making loans to very poor working people can have benefits. It does not move them out of poverty. You're talking about, you know, in general, you know, looking across the board, you're looking at, you know, people that, if they're living on $2 a day, if they get involved with a responsible microfinance institution, they might, you know, get to the point where living on $250 a day. Now, that's a 25% increase in their income, which is enormous, but they're still in poverty. So that's part of the hype. You know, it sounds great, and it is good, but it is not going to end poverty. What it is good for is that it can be a way to provide economic benefits to very poor people, which other economic development strategies often don't do. So for that reason, I think it's something we should keep doing, because it's a way to reach people that, you know, for one reason or another are never going to be employable in the formal sector, and or at least not in our lifetime. And so if you can get some dollars in their hands, that's a good thing. But again, just to be sort of honest about what the impacts are. Another reason it's good is that it's better than money lenders. And people, you know, lending money to very poor people is nothing new. It's been done since the beginning of time, but it's been done in a, you know, a completely informal and often very, very predatory, very destructive way. So if you can replace a money lender who's charging, I mean, Tracy didn't talk much about the interest rates that gets charged for this, but, you know, in the developing world, interest rates for microfinance can range, you know, some around 15%, probably the sort of most common is around 30%, and then it goes on up to 100% for microfinance institutions. And money lenders will typically charge even more, so if you're undercutting them, that's a good thing. What I believe, you know, we ought to do is really look at it for what it really is, and get beyond the hype. Another factor, when you read about it and sort of are asked to invest or donate or whatever, it's described as, you know, this is making loans to people to engage in productive economic activities. They're going to buy a goat, they're going to buy a sewing machine, da da da. In fact, the research shows that, you know, 30 to 60%, and so 60% being on the high end, of the money actually goes to consumption. So it's going, people in a lot of communities, especially agricultural communities, have very uneven income flows over the course of the year, and so they use the microcredit to sort of smooth their consumption. And they might use it to pay for, to buy school supplies and school uniforms, you know, which is, again, a good thing, but it's not like increasing the family's income. That's another sort of thing about the hype, that, you know, the impact data, a lot of the, I mean, our institution, which is small and which does rely on charity, the kindness of strangers, you know, we really rigorously measure the impacts of what we do, and we really screen people to make sure that the loan is actually for a productive business purpose. That's what we feel like is the best use of our resources. A lot of the institutions internationally just simply aren't collecting that impact data. It's very hard to do, and they just don't. And so a lot of the sort of, you know, positives about microfinance are based on kind of anecdotal information and stories as opposed to real data. So why is it getting so much hype? I think it's worth thinking about. And I think it largely just has to do with this. It's a very powerful story. It's this idea that, you know, there's a way through market forces to lift people out of poverty. And we don't have to rely on, you know, charity. I don't have to give anything. I'm a rich person. I don't have to give anything up. And everybody wins. And, you know, there's this nice story about the seamstress with her sewing machine and her, you know, the dignity for work. And then I'm not saying the story isn't, that part of the story is true. But, again, I think that what it ends up doing, with that story being what it is, it can have the effect of crowding out and perverting other types of interventions that we actually need if we're going to really seriously do something about poverty. You know, we need to do something about healthcare, we need to do something about education, there are a lot of issues. And what you find in people doing international development work is everyone all of a sudden has to have a microcredit component to their program, even if it doesn't make any sense. So that's kind of a pernicious impact of it. It's also, I think it, you know, it's because it's such a sort of compelling story, a lot of resources are flowing to it that maybe might better flow towards investments in slightly larger businesses that have job creation potential. If you look at countries that have actually done something, the countries that have had lots and lots of microcredit haven't really seen any significant increase in GDP. The countries that have actually had, you know, poverty, real impact in poverty, it's been through industrialization, it's been through industries that create good paying jobs. I don't know if any of you read some of the articles that were here, but I found the argument very compelling, you know, this idea like, okay, we have a choice, we can make loans to 20 seamstresses, you know, in the same village, all to sort of make dresses and compete with each other because they don't have any way to export, or we can make a loan to start a factory and make dresses and export. And, you know, sure, there are going to be issues around working conditions at the factory, and nothing's, you know, far from perfect, et cetera. But just in terms of sort of creating economic impact and wealth to be, you know, wealth, the latter strategy is going to work better, but it's just not as compelling a story. But I really, I do think that we need more resources towards sort of what the New Yorker guy, James Sirecki, called the missing middle. You know, that may be a place. I'm on the board of an organization, so I do microcredit, and I do believe, you know, I believe we're doing good things. And I think the story is a little different in this country, actually. But I'm on the board of an organization that focuses on, you know, sort of these kind of companies that can create good jobs in low-income communities, larger companies that have potential to grow. And that organization has a much harder time fundraising than I do, you know, for our microcredit. And it's just, it's an interesting conundrum. Let's see. You know, and I take issue with sort of, I agree that charity alone, of course, will not solve problems, but you know, solve the kind of magnitude of problems we have, and certainly market forces, absolutely. But I think it pains me when I hear, and I actually, not saying Tracy did this, she used to run another company that had charity in its name, but the word gets denigrated, and I think a lot of the microfinance movement is a big part of it, and it's like, charity. Well, you know, charity actually is, you know, that's a word we need to rescue. I mean, there's something very noble about doing things to try to help others. It doesn't always work like we intended to, but the impulse is good and often does actually have a big impact. So that's just kind of an aside. So now, talking about commercialization, you know, I think when microfinance is being practiced by a mission-driven organization that is using business principles, et cetera, that's absolutely a good thing. You know, no argument there. When you start to think about really commercializing it, so that you know you've been taking money from investors that are profit motivated, and you've got to deliver those profits, you are going to you're letting a genie out of a bottle, and it's not all just ups like that. If you visit some of these more commercial places, I visited Mi Banco in Peru a year ago, and I was fortunate enough to have some great introductions to the order. This is a commercial bank in Peru that had started as a nonprofit, was taken for profit, and has grown very large, does you know microcredit lending, not just to business, they do it for housing and other things as well. And I went, and at first I met with the CFO and the sort of head of marketing, and it was just wonderful. You know, there's wonderful stories and wonderful, you know, the business is healthy, they have a ton of money, and here's all our wonderful, you know, customers that are happy. And I went to the branch, and I was very impressed with the operation. But so then I went out to a branch way out in the suburbs in a very poor part of Lima, and I met with the branch manager, and, you know, his whole issue was, he was really upset because other banks were coming to this market and he was having to charge lower interest rates than he used to. You know, and I thought, well, that's a good thing, right? I mean, people are paying lower interest rates. And then I went out with the loan officer and to do a couple visits, and she was pushing credit on people. She was saying, you know, don't you want a bigger loan? You can afford a bigger loan. You know, and her whole incentive was just to lend as much money as possible. And so, you know, I think that if we're not careful, we could see that kind of phenomenon really take off. You know, as we get better and better with technology, you know, one of the big barriers to lending money to very poor people is just transaction costs. The transactions are so small, but we're learning to deal with that with technology, and it won't all be good. There'll be some very abusive practices. And I think, you know, I look at what's just happened with the subprime thing here. You know, we developed some new technologies for sort of carving up who has risk, who originates the loan, who does it, and do it in a whole new way, and we basically have just stripped a huge amount of wealth away from a lot of low-income people in this country, and I don't think very much good has come of it, and I fear a little bit for microfinance, because in a lot of the countries where it's being practiced, there's virtually no regulation, so I think that if we don't have the regulatory structures to just unleash the market, may have some really negative consequences. So that's what I'd say on those topics. Thank you.
Sure.
So who thinks that we should commercialize microfinance? And who thinks, and I'll start at that one, and then we'll go to the other side, which is stick with a more kind of non-profit approach to microfinance. So who thinks we should commercialize? It's a non-profit. Oh, come on, you have to vote. Jeez, people. Okay, we're going to do it again. Okay, who thinks we should go to a commercial model for microfinance? Okay, and who thinks that we should stay at the non-profit arena? Well, it's like half and half. All right, so for those of you who think we should stay with the non-profit, those of you who raised your hands, why do you think that? So, so if I understand you correctly, what you're saying is when you're a microfinance organization out in the field in rural Uganda, that someone who could potentially take out a loan might not know exactly what to do with the loan, and so some training accompanying that loan might help that person to be armed with the right skill set needed to be successful with that little loan. But training is expensive, right, which is an excellent point. Okay, chop one to Eric's team. Okay, who else? Who else raised their hand about on the nonprofit side?
Well, I was persuaded by the idea of it becoming too much about making a profit, so that not the efficient amount of spending, lending is done.
And what's too much profit? layup. What's too much profit? Is any profit okay?
I just mean that if it becomes, if the purpose of the process is to make profit instead of helping the poor, then it's not going to be as effective. So no, some profit could be okay, but it shouldn't be the only.
Couldn't you say Eric's point that you are pushing credit, so you have an incentive structure that might not necessarily generate maximal poverty reduction because there's not perfect alignment between poverty reduction and incentives of, let's say, the loan officer?
Yeah, so this is a really key point, right? And it's a huge debate in the industry is if you have two motivations, right? One is getting people out of poverty and the other is maximizing your profits. When and you, those are in conflict, what do you do? And that's the crux of the debate here, and that we face every day. And we get both sides. We're just having fun arguing each. And my position generally falls on the side of we have to enable a profitable and sustainable is kind of the, you know, nice non-profit-y word for profit. Model, because otherwise we won't be able to grow the industry and reach all the people that need to be reached. But there is, I think, a limit to the amount of profit that should be earned. And Eric should have mentioned his side of the story that there is a company called Comportamos, which is in Mexico. It's a microfinance organization that recently went public. It's actually a publicly traded stock on a stock exchange in Mexico. How cool is that? It's like Microsoft being traded on the New York Stock Exchange, right? Except it's in Mexico. And it's a wild success. I know where they make like $1.5 billion valuation now.
Yeah, and the two founders walked away $50 million.
And the founders have $50 million each.
And it started as a nonprofit with subsidized grants, and then they converted it.
Yeah, although the grants contributors, those who contributed the grants made a good penny on the IPO.
Yeah.
So everybody made a good chunk of change.
Place that charges really high interest.
But they charge 100%. They charge 90% interest rates. So it's better than the moneylenders, better than the loan shark down the street, but is 90% too much when you just had this windfall profit go to these private investors? I would argue that it was the greatest
well, maybe the second greatest single moment in the history of microfinance, because it made the entire traditional capital markets world go, what is this again? Microfinance? What is that? And the whole capital markets world said, we can now take this industry seriously. And I think what we're going through right now, we can't see it because we're in the middle of it right now, but as we look back in time, maybe 10 years from now, this will have been, that moment when that IPO happened will be a watershed moment for the industry. I think it will, the growth rates that we're seeing now are 30%, north of 30%, and we're gonna see this idea, which has kind of slowly grown, you know, and slowly crept up to reaching 100 million people, we're gonna hit 1 billion people in no time because of this change in thinking. Yeah.
I respect a lot what both of you said, and I realize that it's maybe the impact of microfinance is a little bit smaller than, you know, in sort of the mythology, but I still support the market-driven approach because I really think that it could make a much bigger impact in terms of bringing in capital, and it just, you know, I really respect all the hard work that goes into NGOs, but as a sector, it's very limited in terms of growth and impact, and most of the big non-government or non-profit organizations in the world that are sustainable and big are actually subsidized by governments. So, you know, one thing is like the World Bank type organizations, which I, you know, have some experience with. They're actually non-profits, and they do these market distortions. Like Bolivia has a lot of country risk, so you actually charge it less of a loan. This is to a government, not an individual, but that makes it really hard. It actually incentivizes bad behavior, and just like the traditional loan shark, it kind of has a way of its own system of sustainability, so that these countries are always in debt. They always give them, they always let them enough room to survive to make it sustainable. But so I don't know. I know it's not a magic bullet or a panacea or something, but I still think. Having said that, regulation has got to be important so you don't get these really tangled up financial instruments no one understands and passed around. And I don't know. Well, what are some ways that you think that regulation could be put in place that would be a check and balance and protect the rights of the borrowers?
Yeah. I think those, you made a number of really good points in there. And I think that there is... On the regulation point, there's definitely room for the local governments to actually set some regulations that support the growth of microfinance. Like right now, you can't invest in India and get your money out. I mean, look at the growth rate in India. I mean, that's just craziness that they're imposing on their own economy unnecessarily. That's limiting their growth, right? So I think that there is a role to play, but what I like better is not relying on governments to figure all of this stuff out, but actually the transparency idea of, you know, like what Marketplace is trying to do, where if we can put investments up there and allow you to choose, well, I want to focus on the poorest of the poor, let me search these different investment opportunities by which one of these organizations targets the poorest people, instead of just searching on the rate of return, right? You might take a lower rate of return because you know the organization's focusing on the poorest strata of the poor, right? So you, as an investor, can make that choice. And we're starting to see that happening in the industry, but very informally and without this transparency that I'm hoping the industry adopts, where you're starting to see investors say, you know, I'm demanding that you do X, Y, and Z that are poverty-focused, you know, addressing poverty, kind of social goals that then enable the MFI to focus on those more than profit maximizing goals. So it's still a free market, I think, is the point. And then helps the MFI to balance those two social return and financial return objectives. Okay.
I think the best argument you know, to sort of allow things to go as they go is that, you know, in other words, to, you know, full speed ahead commercialization, make the credit available, you know, it's just this argument that, you know, people have free will, they can do as they choose, they want the credit, they'll take it on these terms, you know, so they should have it. And, I mean, I think that's a hard argument to refute. On the other hand, I think, you know, as what's happened is you've had some trailblazing organizations starting back in the 70s, and it didn't just start with Muhammad Yunus, it started in Latin America as well, you know, finding out that you could lend money to very poor people and get it paid back, and that some of them, you know, would have positive things happen in their lives. I think it's, again, not as many as we're led to believe that have really positive outcomes. And then you've had sort of larger and larger scale efforts to do this, again, most of the way along with a real mission behind it. You know, with this is about helping people, and we want to make people's lives better. Well, you're going to have a whole new set of actors come in. It's, you know, there's nothing, if you've got a, you show me a business model where I can lend money at 50% interest, I can have a very high return on equity, there's no regulation stopping me from coming into this market, and if it's in fact true that there are, you know, we're only serving 10% of the market, so there's a huge unmet demand, there's going to be a lot of abuses along the way before you get to, you may eventually get to the point where competition brings rates down and you have, you know, some kind of more rational system. Although, you know, I'm not an economist, my father is, but I'm not. But there, I look at things like payday lending in this country, and, you know, those rates aren't coming. I mean, the competition doesn't seem to be doing anything about that. I mean, that's an incredibly abusive type of lending, and it's flourishing. So there's like this whole, and maybe that's just a symptom of our society and it won't exist in other countries, but I do think there's a strong tendency in people to, when they're offered cheap, well not cheap, when they're offered easy credit, to get in big trouble. So that's where I get stuck, is sort of how do you, I mean, I'm all for scaling this up and offering this opportunity to any person that has a good shot at taking advantage of it in a way that's going to be good for their family and their community, but how do you do that without also ensnaring a lot of other people in sort of debt traps, which, and again, I think about, you know, if the capital markets get interested in this asset, in this, you know, business, they are not going to care at all about whether people are being helped or not. So, and you know, this question of if I have to make a choice between making money and helping people, and again, not get out of poverty, become slightly less poor, I think is a better way to put it. If Wall Street's providing the money, the choice is going to be very clear. I mean, there's going to be no choice. You're going to come down the side of making money. That's my rebuttal for it.
So I guess now, both of them step to the front and just throw out questions, addressing either to both or to either one as you may choose.
And as you go ahead.
No. The question of what, you know, which we should do seems a little bit academic, and that we can't control it. The genie,
good thing we're
out of
the university.
The genie is out of the bottle. Right.
The genie is out of the bottle.
It's already out of the bottle.
These markets are going to go full speed ahead, whether we like it or not. I think a very relevant question, though, is what do we as individuals in this room do? Where do we place our bets? What kind of giving or investing do we support? And what fire do we want to fuel? Because the full commercialization is going forward, and it's unregulated, and it's the Wild West. And the people out there who are subject to sort of the greed is good type of lender are going to find themselves pushed, in some cases, closer to slavery than prosperity. And I don't think we want to be a part of that. But we have the choice of where we want to play and what kind of influence we can put on Wall Street.
No, which is, I mean, I think like MicroPlace is great, you know, especially, you know, you got to get that transparent information about the organization, and not just sort of their financial dealings, but, you know, their procedures for sort of ensuring they're having a positive impact. That's where we need to go. That's not going to stop the genie. The genie's going to just, like I say, if there's profit to be made, the money will flow there. There's nothing you can do about it, but you're right. What we can at least think about how we talk about it, and we don't want, I'm arguing, you know, don't just jump on the bandwagon and close your eyes to the whole story.
It seems to me like in order to be to the advantage of both the lenders and the borrowers, that you need a lot more statistics, because to transform it into a formal asset class for, you know, investment banking, that sort of thing, you need more data, sort of long term, and on the other hand, to make regulations to protect people, you need more in-depth information about, well, what's a reasonable limit, you know, and so to prevent people from pushing credit.
There's a lot of kind of efforts underway right now to create that infrastructure that you're referring to. So MicroPlace is one, but there's also a site called The Mix, and they're basically, you know, every major microfinance institution in the world is on the site with tons of data there. And that's a good start. You can compare microfinance organizations there. But the part that's missing that we're working really hard on, because it'll really help us, is there's no Morningstar rates mutual funds, right? So if you were to buy a mutual fund, you'd look at the Morningstar rating, and on a scale of 1 to 5 or whatever it is, you would see what Morningstar thinks about this mutual fund before you buy it. And pretty much the whole world does that, right? So it's pretty much a standard third-party rating agency that gives you a great way to compare any mutual fund out there. Well, there's no equivalent in microfinance. In fact, I would argue that for microfinance mutual funds, we should use Morningstar, right? We should be consistent with exactly what the capital markets are used to. And similarly, if you were to go buy a bond, like a corporate bond or whatever, or a treasury or something, or, you know, IBM has a corporate bond you might buy, for example, they would be rated by like an S&P or a Fitch or a Moody's type rating agency, right? And it'd be like AAA or AA or BBB or whatever it is. And that's exactly what we're doing with the securities we sell, is going out and getting rating agencies to rate them, so you could actually compare, how does this, you know, Comportamos bond compare to my IBM bond? And you actually have real comparisons. Then we really do have an asset class. Today, you're operating without that information. You're limited in the information you have, then it's hard to consider these as real investments.
But without the, yes, but it's like, it's, this is getting sold to as something that's ending poverty, and like that has to be, you know, that.
Right. So where are the social metrics?
It's like,
yeah,
you know,
that's only half the story.
It's only half the story.
Yeah.
Or stop talking about the poverty thing and just, you know, it's fine. I mean, it's a business.
Right.
You know, it's fine. I mean,
yeah.
So we're
trying to develop. We're basically going through. So one of the things that I really dislike about where the microfinance industry is today is that everybody is benefiting from the hype. So nobody wants to actually go get those social metrics.
Yeah, yeah.
They don't want to let you, you know, see their dirty laundry. But it's actually not that hard to develop and have rigorous social metrics. Just there's no incentive to do so right now.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you open any newspaper and there's a story about microfinance today and it's all glowing, right?
Yeah.
It's like the story of Pooja and her sewing machine or whichever story I gave you at the beginning of my talk. And, you know, every article has that story, and it, you know, brings a tear to your eye every time. So what motivation do they have to actually come out with those social metrics?
Right.
And so MicroPlace, we're actually going to put one up, a social metric showing the level of poverty you're addressing, not
mm-hmm.
the amount, that, not the
at
number
least.
Of people who get out of poverty, because we're not that far yet.
Yeah.
But that'll come soon. And then investors will be able to see that. So if you don't have that metric up there, you,
got it if you want to attract any capital. So hopefully we'll force the industry to adopt it. So,
Professor.
Yeah, I have a question about the squeezing out argument that Tracy made, and I want to push you a bit on that argument, because it's not clear to me if indeed there's lots of unmet demand for microloans, that it should be any problem at all that there's a small nonprofit sector that's kind of culling a bit. And then after that, there's so much unmet demand that there's plenty of room for for-profit lending to occur, that is presumably the potential recipient of this microloan shouldn't be troubled that maybe some people are getting a better deal. From her or his point of view, all that matters is that at the prevailing for-profit rate, 10%, 15%, whatever it is, you are going to be able to optimize on your life chances. And so there shouldn't be any squeezing out, as I see it. And so, again, I guess I'm taking you on the very aggressive argument that not only should we commercialize, but it's a bad thing that we have a nonprofit sector in place in the market that's kind of distorting opportunities or reducing opportunities for-profit sector.
So I'm not sure I follow your question. Are you saying that, you know, from Pooja's perspective, if she has an access to a loan, that's what matters? Or the argument about the crowding out argument is that, you know, if Morgan Stanley's got $100 million to invest in Compartamos, right, but the World Bank's in there with $20 million at a lower rate, and then Compartamos doesn't want Morgan Stanley's $100 million because it's too expensive, and Morgan Stanley's $100 million goes away, it's $100 million less in capital that's flowing into the microfinance industry.
But
right?
why wouldn't that capital go into the other unmet opportunities for microloans
I think there are probably countries where this is happening. Like, I know in Tibet, my father-in-law does microcredit in Tibet, and they're actually the State Bank of China is providing loans at 3% in a big way. So it does, you know, it makes it hard to, you know, get any other kind of operation going, and which, you know, as long as they're meeting the demand and doing it well, it's fine. But if they're not, you know, then you're sort of retarding the growth of the industry. But I would think his argument is like, well, since there's really pretty limited amount of that subsidized money, so was it really going to crowd out, especially if there's so much demand? I mean,
like it hinges
right,
on
right,
being under
right,
that demand.
Yeah.
Like if there's
so, right, I understand. So there are different kind of tiers of microfinance organizations in the world. The top tier are, you know, have a long history of being really well run, and, you know, great financials you can evaluate, and you can go visit their operations, and they've got IT systems, and they're, you know, really good, and relatively lower risk, right? And then as you get down in the lower tiers, there's a lot more of them, but they're much more risky, right? They don't have as long track records, their management team isn't as proven, maybe they just haven't been around that long, they don't have necessarily the same infrastructure, that kind of thing. Those are much riskier investments. And so what the kind of pro-commercial folks are saying is, you know, that where the more kind of public sector capital should go is to the riskier MFIs, so that the good ones there are able to grow and become the top tier MFIs, and,
mm-hmm.
you know, some won't, but that we can nurture the growth of some younger or less experienced or more risky.
And that's the logical place for that kind of capital.
And that's the logical place for that kind of capital. They shouldn't be competing with the Morgan Stanleys for the top tier. So. Yeah.
I was wondering if there's a way to, it seems like this is almost just like any other lending, except it's really hard to regulate because you're usually investing in another country. And it's, you know, to a person, not institution, it's really hard to, I mean, it's probably not getting regulated in that country. And if you try to regulate it, say in the US, if that's where most of the creditors are, they can just go overseas. So is there a way to regulate it from the outside besides just expecting the organizations to be transparent and honest and good?
I don't think there is going to be a way to. No, but I think the best.
Or maybe as a nonprofit. I think as a nonprofit, there is a way to regulate it.
I think the best thing you could do is sort of try to develop a set of, and there are, there have been efforts, you know, develop a set of principles for how the business is conducted, that, you know, as in, you know, how much interest and fees you're charging, those are probably the main ones, you know, maybe do you screen the borrowers for the use of the money, or, you know, do you evaluate their overall indebtedness? You know, some things that would get at that sort of, let's make sure we're doing more good than harm, and they would be principles, and then you would say, you know, you'd have some kind of rating agency, might be a nonprofit, whatever, that sort of goes out and, you know, that it certifies institutions. That way, at least the capital that seeks to have that double bottom line, there's some capital that will not care, the majority, but that which seeks to have that double bottom line would have, you know, some information. I don't know what else much you could really do.
I actually don't think regulation is the answer. I think, you know, once you're dealing with, like, Hugo Chavez, you're screwed, right? Like, you know, he's imposing all kinds of wacky rules on microfinance in Venezuela that are, you know, really detrimental to the industry. And, you know, a lot of the developing world countries just, I mean, their biggest problem is their government, right? So if we're relying on government to solve regulatory environment problems, we're screwed. So I'm totally in the camp of, you know, if investment vehicles or opportunities like Marketplace allow you to see those Morningstar ratings, right? That's gonna channel the capital towards the right. You know, Darwinism will work, essentially. So I'm really much more in favor of the developing these third party agencies and giving them, like, shining a spotlight on that, you know, those ratings. Like, MicroRate is a microfinance rating agency that goes out and rates these guys. But they don't have a really good spotlight on them, so we're going to start listing their ratings on Marketplace and hopefully shine a spotlight with the, you know, thousands of people that come to our site every day. And that will hopefully channel capital towards the ones that get the A rating, not the B rating. So, but I'm a bit biased on that one.
Can you talk about microlending for purposes other than entrepreneurship? Because not everyone's an entrepreneur. How do we help people who don't want to start a business?
Yeah. Well, there's certainly a lot of it done for housing, you know, sort of helping people build a house, add on to their, I mean, in most of the world, they don't have 30-year mortgages, and so instead you borrow small amounts and add on to your house a little bit at a time. And, you know, again, I think that's obviously a very, if done responsibly, is a very positive thing for people. I hear things about, like, micro insurance. I don't know much about it.
So,
you know, which, again, could be a great product for people.
And just to clarify, when I kept saying the billion, there's a lot more than a billion poor people in the world, but the billion number is the number of people who are self-employed.
That are self-employed.
Right, so that's it's the market that's addressable with microfinance. But it's important to point out that there's a lot more poor people who can't. Microfinance is not a panacea. So there are other tools. But I think to add on, housing is a really good example. There's also some really cool models that are starting up now around private sector schooling, right? I mean, you think somebody who lives on a dollar a day can't afford to pay for private schooling, right? It seems like, you know, especially in the U.S. where, like, only rich kids go to private schools, right? But the reality is that in many, many parts of the developing world, parents will actually pay, you know, like 50 cents a month to send their kid to a private school. And, the fees are extremely low, but, and that school actually runs profitably. The teacher's running a profitable school, and there's microfinance models that are funding these private schools. Same thing's happening in healthcare.
Well, and I think a lot of the borrowers, even of the business microfinance institutions, are using it for those kinds of purposes, and that's been shown.
Yeah.
You know, they're using it to pay school fees,
right,
which, you know, is good investment generally.
Yeah.
Well, I had another. Oh, savings is the other thing. I mean, there's actually a huge pent-up demand for savings vehicles. You know, in a lot of parts of the world, there's no safe place. The only way to save is, like, to buy a pig. I mean, or keep the money.
Or gold.
Yeah, you know, which is very risky. I mean, you can get it stolen. So safe, you know, that's another great service that, and that's one I feel is unmitigated. That's good. You know, I mean, if you can more formalize ways for savings that are safe, you know.
I have another question. No. It's about, I thought it was a kind of compelling argument about the dignity of treating the recipients of microloans as entrepreneurs and as a business transaction rather than one of charity. And so I wonder how that position can be reconciled with the phenomenon in which people seem to be willing to pay a premium, as it were, for socially responsible instruments. That is, they seem to be paying extra for the feel good of helping others. So that would be understood as you know, part charity and part investment. So you're not getting the full return; you're getting, you know, the socially responsible return, and presumably because we value the altruism or the whatever the feeling is that charity generates in the person who's giving it. Now, if one's troubled by outright 100% charity, shouldn't one also be just as troubled by partial charity? And shouldn't you then come down? Wouldn't the kind of the consistent view being that you shouldn't really encourage socially responsible investing either?
I have a follow-up question somewhat related to that. So in one of your remarks, you seem to assume that your investment decision will always be independent of your donation decisions. And David's latest comment suggested that in the long run, they would not. So if I buy into the model of investing in microcredit, might it lead to changing in the way I donate or the amount I donate?
Yeah, this is really good question. And one of the things we didn't know until we just launched in the fall, and we didn't know before we launched how things would shake out. And well, it turns out that our returns are pretty modest right now. The investment opportunities range from 1% to 3% right now. We have a 5%, a 7%, and an 8% instrument coming, new issuers that will be added to the site at higher returns. But right now, they're only like 1% to 3%. And all the feedback we get is, you know, great, here's $100, here's $400, here's $1,000, you know, from our investors. Call me once you got 8%, or, you know, call me once you got 5%, because I got a whole lot more capital for you when you're there. So they're still thinking with their charity wallets at the 1%, 2%, 3%. And I'm like, well, that doesn't make any sense. It's 103% better than charity, right? But people don't think that way. They just think, oh, it's just a, you know, 2% return, whatever. That's kind of the same as charity. Actually, I should modify that statement, because in today's world, with Ben Bernanke,
3%
loaning,
bad,
yeah, 3% is actually pretty good. That's better than what your money market will yield. That's kind of, you know, wreaking havoc on everybody's thinking. But so the returns are actually looking better and better. But I think, you know, that won't last for long. And so, you know, I've been very aggressive in pushing the microfinance industry to say, yeah, you can raise some capital if you want to list an investment at 2%, but you raise a heck of a lot more if you have something that's north of 5%.
Having been in sort of community development finance world for 15 years, I think most people just really separate those things, and that this idea that there could be this sort of melding of the two has been, you know, yes, there's socially responsible investing, but I mean the amount people are willing to sacrifice in terms of return when you're talking significant dollars is tiny. You know, they if it's and then the only really the only institutions in this country anyway that sort of will provide that kind of capital that's sort of below market rate for social purpose are banks, and it's because they're regulated under the Community Reinvestment Act and they sort of have to do it. Foundations, you know, we keep expecting all the big foundations to start using their huge endowments, you know, to do some investing with a social purpose, and they're not, it's really not happening. It's still a tiny, you know, piece of what they do, and that's something people thought was really going to take off, and it hasn't, so.
It's happening in Europe.
More so, it's
in the U.S., we all have this psyche, like, we're all charitable. It doesn't matter if you're wealthy or poor or, you know, who you are, everybody is charitable in the U.S. And then we go invest our assets in Philip Morris. and there's nothing in between, really.
Right.
In Europe, it's a completely different mentality. Like, socially responsible investing is common, which means I should really move.
Marketplace Europe.
Right, yeah. Yeah, it's an interesting challenge for us.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.